Welcome to the Sportscast, July 5th, 2023. If you haven't yet, please subscribe in all our channels, YouTube, Twitch, Twitter, and Apple Podcasts. You can also listen to us on your smart speaker. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please leave a rating and a review. It will help us out tremendously. You can also listen to us 24/7 on online radio. Also, check out our website, thesportscast.net, and our Twitter. Follow us on Twitter on thesportscast1 and also on Instagram, thesportscast1. You could also get our app, The Sportscast, for iOS. Today, we have a special guest. It is Gold Cup season. It is the biggest soccer tournament in the Americas, I would say, in North America, Central America, and the Caribbean. And we got a special American legend, Joe Hashnick. He is a former soccer player, referee, and broadcaster. Joe, welcome to the Sportscast.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be with you.
So, Joe, you originally started as a goalkeeper. Can you tell us your intro of how you got into the beautiful game?
Well, like I mentioned just before we went on the air, I grew up in New York City, and actually in the Greenpoint section of Brooklyn. And there was a park right in the middle of it called McCarran's Park, where there was soccer played every Sunday in the Sunday ethnic leagues that exist in New York City. And I was a big hockey fan at the time too. I would go to most of the Ranger games in Madison Square Garden, when you could go there with a high school ID card and you could get in for 40 cents. Lots have changed, obviously. But anyway, I saw the similarities between soccer and hockey. And when I was in high school, I sat down in an English class by luck next to two Ukrainian boys, and they were on the soccer team. And we started to talk about soccer and hockey, and they asked me if I ever played soccer. And I said, no, but I watch it every Sunday. And they said, would you like to try out? You could be the goalkeeper. So I went up to the gym, and we had a tryout in the gym on a hardwood floor, and put a couple of mats down in front of two poles. And because I knew angle play from watching hockey and watching those soccer games on Sunday, I was able to make quite a few saves, some with my hands, some with my feet, some with my face. And I made the JV team that year. And then the next year, the varsity, and I got to be pretty good. The Ukrainian kids took me to their club in New York City, the New York Ukrainians, and I grew up in that program as a junior player and later as a senior player. And then I got a scholarship, a half scholarship to Long Island University as a goalkeeper. Me and another player, Ray Klaveka, who later went on to coach the Cosmos, were the first two scholarship players for LIU Brooklyn. And we turned that program around in a couple of years. And then when the head coach became the Dita students, they asked me to be the coach. And that's how I got into coaching. And then I was a physical education major, so I had to learn how to teach so many different sports, but also how to officiate them. So I could officiate basketball, flag football, soccer, boxing even, volleyball. And so when my playing career ended, I went into officiating seriously. And that's how I, became an official sometime after the, I would say around 1970.
And of course, Joe has been through a lot, being goalkeeper, coaching, and refereeing. Let's go back into when you were a member of the New York Ukrainians. You became the winner of the 1965 U.S. Open Cup. Can you tell us your experience with that?
Well, actually, to be fair, I was the backup goalkeeper on that team. We had an excellent starting goalkeeper. And what I would do would be I would play the preliminary game as a what they call the reserves. So I would play that game and then sit the bench for the first team if needed. I did get on the field once, but not as a goalkeeper, but as a forward, when some of our players who would fly down from Toronto every Sunday, guys like Gordon Bradley, who became coach of Cosmos, Ted Purdon, some others, John Young, their plane got fogged out and we were short players. And I had the players pass that enabled me to play. So I actually played on the field and we tied that game 0-0. I think we played with 10 players and that was my one experience playing as a field player. But that team went on to win the Open Cup in 1965-66. And you know, there was a period of time when the Philadelphia Ukrainians had won a couple years in a row. And then the New York Ukrainians won. And then shortly after that, I went to play because I really wanted to play. I didn't want to be the backup. So I went over to the American Soccer League and played for the Newark Ukrainians for two or three seasons before moving to Connecticut.
Tell us, how was the sport back then compared to now? It seems like what I've always heard, there was a lot of immigrants playing soccer, but not many Americans. Can you tell us what was it like to play soccer back then?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, I think I was the only born in America player in the German-American League, even the name of the league, right? It was called the German-American League. So the teams we played against were like Inter Giuliana, which was an Italian team, Blau-Weiß-Gotchi, which is still around today, which was a German team, the German-Hungarians, Eintracht, which had their own field in Astoria, the Greek Americans, so a lot of immigrants from after World War II that came to America were playing in these leagues, and the soccer was quite good, as you can imagine. Sometimes teams would play or would come over here from Europe to play exhibition games against these teams, and we held our own. Partly because we could play, but also the fields were such that, you know, they had no grass. They were made sometimes of crushed cinder and stone and sand and mud and nothing like what people play on today. There was no artificial surfaces back then. And the fields were few and far between, so they were overused. There would be a junior game at 11, a reserve team game at 1, the big team would play at 3, and this would happen on Saturday, Sunday, and Wednesday. So there was never any time for anything to grow. And if you made a diving save or a slide tackle back then, you came up with some serious raspberries and picking out stones out of your, out of the sides of your thighs.
Unbelievable. I don't see any mention of your involvement with NASL. Were you ever involved or ever got close to it? Or
no, what happened was I was doing pretty well as a referee. I became national referee out of Connecticut, but never FIFA, never international referee. And then I went into the indoors. I became the head referee for the major indoor soccer league, and that curtailed my outdoor experience and kind of labeled me as an indoor referee. I'm not saying I would have made it into the NASL, but you know, many of my friends who I worked with did. But I began to focus on the indoor game, you know, partly because I knew hockey, like I told you earlier, and we were playing on a hockey rink with field turf on it by that time, sometimes laid over ice. So I was, several hundred games and was also the head of the referees for that league, and actually started the first full-time referee program certainly in America, but maybe the world, where we employed six referees to do all of our games. So that because the game was different, we wanted the referees to learn the game, to learn the players, to be familiar, because it was very difficult to come from outdoor indoor because it was so fast and you had to make a decision like every 4 seconds. And there were advantages being played off the wall, off the backboard. So it was much easier to go from indoor to outdoor, which was like a piece of cake after a while. So we hired six referees full time. I was one of them, and we refereed most of the games in that league that time for quite a few years.
Refereeing, what really inspired you to get involved with refereeing?
Well, when you stop playing, you could become a coach, and you know, certainly I did that. I was the assistant coach for the first five-a-side World Cup team, where we won the bronze medal. And I was also the assistant coach for the 1990 World Cup team, the first U.S. team to qualify for the World Cup in 40 years. But I always had this interest in refereeing, and it was, you know, fun for me. And it was a prolongation of your playing career. You were on the field, you worked up a sweat, you dealt with the players one-on-one, you were responsible for their safety. And if you did a good job at the end of the game, maybe if you were lucky, players from each team would come over and say, "Hey, great game, ref, thank you." You know, that was a very rare occurrence. But one of the things I prided myself on was that the losing team and or the visiting team, sometimes it's the same, but the losing team and visiting team always got a fair shake. So that, you know, that wasn't always the case back in soccer in the day.
Quite impressive. Never knew the opponent or the team that lost would say thank you to the ref. Times have changed now.
Well, it was like, you know, as a goalkeeper, you don't often get credit for winning the game. You sometimes get credit for losing the game. But, you know, if you save a penalty, then that stands out. And maybe your teammates or others would say, you know, great game. But typically, if you made one mistake that led to a goal and it was 1-0, you know, they didn't want to talk to you after the game. So there was, you know, some benefit to refereeing that you just felt part of the bigger picture. And it was a good feeling if you did a good job.
You probably get asked this a lot, but I wanted to hear it again. What's your opinion over VAR?
VAR, VAR?
Yeah, VAR, VAR, yeah.
Video assistant referee. Well, I do get asked, and I will say this. If it's done right, okay, if it's done right, if it's put into work according to how it's supposed to be, so that we're only looking at clear and obvious errors on, you know, the four things that VAR can look at: penalty or no penalty, goal or no goal, red card or not a red card, or mistaken identity. Those are the only four things that VAR can look at. So it's kind of, I've heard this, it's kind of like a parachute for the referee, because if you're out there refereeing and you know that if you make a mistake, and it's easy to make a mistake because you only have one look at a play from one angle, okay? The VAR, depending on how many TV cameras there are, he could have 15 looks and from 15 different angles. And if he recognizes, or she recognizes, that you've made a clear and obvious error on a pivotal call, a call that can affect the outcome of a game, such as the four things that I just mentioned, then that's a safety net for you. So they ring you in your ear and you say, "Hey, take a look at this. I'm going to show you a different angle," right? And if you see the different angle and you like it, you can change your call. And if you don't like it, you can stick with your call, because at the end of the day, the referee makes the final decision. So it's an important safety net. You know, how many goals in the history of soccer have been disallowed for offside when the assistant referee has raised their flag, and then the video shows the player was onside, right? But it's now too late. You couldn't do anything about it. But now the way they make it work, the assistant referee keeps their flag down until the play is finished. If it goes in the goal, every goal is reviewed, and they can award the goal. If it's offside, they can say no goal, offside. So, or the assistant raises his flag, you know, after the play is finished to make sure that, for example, the team doesn't get a corner kick that they don't deserve. So yeah, I'm a fan of it, obviously, if it's done right. If it's done wrongly, where the VAR interferes on too many things, doesn't follow the protocol, doesn't have a high bar to what's clear and obvious, and gets so involved that you have three or four on-field reviews in each half, that ruins the game. Ruins the game for everybody, the players, the spectators, the TV people. And of course, as a broadcaster, I like VAR because it gives me an opportunity to see a play a second time or a third time, and to then have a chance to explain the laws of the game to the listeners, and or, in my opinion, what led into the referee making that decision.
Yeah, and I know for the FIFA Women's World Cup, the ref will have the opportunity to speak in loudspeaker of what was the decision.
Right.
Which was a
deal. That was an experiment that was used in the last FIFA Club World Cup, and also in the recent under 20 World Cup. So the FIFA liked it and is now given permission for it to be used in Women's World Cup. So after the ref looks at the monitor or gets a message from the VAR, they're going to be able to speak to the stadium and or the broadcasters through their microphone and explain to us what led to the decision. You know, some of us, like you or me, for example, we probably know what led to the decision, but not everybody, you know, is familiar with the laws of the game. Not everybody has been a referee. Not everybody has, you know, lived the game. Not everybody sees it the same way. So this will be important addition to the Women's World Cup.
Yeah, very important. And obviously, they're going to take that approach from the NFLs when like the refs, you know, even the NBA does it, I think, too. Like they kind of announced what happened.
And I think in rugby in Australia, rugby rules football, whatever they call it. Chaos, yeah. In the chaos game.
Yeah, exactly. Which league you've noticed have done it not so well or very well? Of course, like the MLS has VAR, the Premier League in most of Europe, but which league you say, man, these guys kind of need to kind of tie it up a little bit?
Well, it takes practice. So regardless of the league, when you just start the program, you know, there's the VAR is part of the referee team, and it takes teamwork. So regardless of the league, every league that initiates VAR and is using video assistants that have been referees, but it's new to them as video assistant, they struggle with it. You have to have a boss, somebody in charge to set the standards. So for example, when Howard Webb came to MLS, he really brought some experience with him and a mindset of how he wanted it to work. Now in MLS, for example, they don't have the 32 cameras that you see at a World Cup game. Sometimes they're doing a game with 10 or with 11 or 12 cameras. So, and especially on offside, often in MLS, for example, the assistant referee is asked, is this offside or not? Or the VAR is asked to review a play offside, not offside, but they don't have the right camera angle because the camera is not in line with the second to last defender or the ball at the moment the ball is played. So they have to give it some leeway, okay? In fact, in the last World Cup, if you remember, in Qatar, we had, for the first time, what's called semi-automated offside technology. 12 additional cameras monitoring 50 spots on every player's body and the ball, so that in an instant, you know, as soon as the ball was played, they knew if the player was in an offside position. That eliminated all of the time that it would take for the VAR to look, is he offside, is he not offside, blah, blah, blah. Look at all the different camera angles. That's very, very expensive. MLS doesn't have it. We don't have it in Gold Cup. I'm not sure. I'll have to find out if they're going to use it in Women's World Cup. I would imagine they would. But that's a big plus. So I don't want to disparage any league. But if you have a game where, if you have a Sunday of 14 games, and five of those games have three VAR reviews each, that's overkill. Typically, you should see one on-field review about one every three games.
I like that approach, Dr. Joe. You mentioned broadcast. You've broadcast since 2013 with Fox Sports. You've done the Gold Cups. You've done like the Women's World Cups and the Men's World Cups. MLS, you done Copa America as well, and Confederations Cup.
And Champions League too, because when I first started, Fox was doing Champions League, and I was flying to Los Angeles every Monday because the games were on Tuesday and Wednesday, and I would stay there overnight and sometimes even do Europa League on Thursday before coming home. But now they set me up with a home cam. I'm going to show you. You see behind me.
Cool.
That's okay. So that's what I watch the game on, and that little round thing that's on top, that's the camera. Okay, I have to take off the lid, and behind me is the big monitor backdrop, rather. Let's see if it's connected.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I see. Okay, I see
Hawk Sports. Right behind you. Yeah,
the bottom part will disappear momentarily. It usually takes a while. Yep, there it is. And so sometimes they want to bring me on camera. They can. But the rest of the time, I'm connected with earphones like you have, a microphone. And that's how I speak during the game. And they say, Dr. Joe, what do you think about that?
which tournament was your favorite? I know you covered several, but which one has been your favorite so far that, wow, this was fun to cover it and a lot of challenging plays, but it was great?
Well, you know, it's all high-level soccer. So I love watching the big games, you know, because you see the great players, but you also see some very good referees. And so, I mean, you know, the World Cup last one, that not Qatar, but the one in Russia, which was the first one with VAR. That was interesting because they were just learning, you know, how to use it. This one got better, in Qatar with VAR. And as we go to Australia, New Zealand, it will be, they'll be using VAR, but they'll be using a lot of personnel in the VAR booth that really don't have yet that amount of experience with it. So I'm hopeful that everyone learns quickly and that the games are not interrupted too much unnecessarily. But all, you know, all the games, all the stuff that I've worked, I don't have a favorite. I like having to say something in every game, obviously. And you know, it's like every once in a while they ask me, how's this referee doing? You know, when there hasn't been a VAR, but there's maybe an injury or something. And I, you know, I'd like to be able to explain why I think the referee's doing well, or if it's less than well, you know, explain the reasons why. I got to know, you know, I was a match commissioner for over 30 matches in CONCACAF. And before this assignment as a broadcaster. So I got to know some of the referees that are still out there. And I used to be able to be invited to the referee seminar for Gold Cup. Brian Hall was the head of referees there for a while, and he would invite me, and I'd sit in the room with them. And that was a big advantage because I knew what the initiatives were, you know, what the expectations were. And what happens now in every World Cup or every big tournament, they have what's called a welcoming video for the teams, but it's the same video that's used in referee preparation. So like for this World Cup, CONCACAF shared that with me, their new administrator, Nicola Rizzoli, shared it with me. And so I'm able to see the teaching points for the referees, but also what's been shared with the players. And what's really interesting, you know, the first thing is always safety of the players. So in the last World Cup in Qatar, there was not a single red card for serious foul play, except the goalkeeper from Wales, when he came out of the goal and he took out the player, the opposing player, I don't remember the team. And at first the referee gave a yellow, went to VAR, recommendation for a red, he came back and changed his call to a red. That was the only player sent off for serious foul play in the entire tournament. Now in the Gold Cup, okay, I think we've had one red card for second yellow. Okay, we've had three coaches sent off, but we haven't had a straight red. Oh, yes, we have. Yes, we have. We had one straight red. Let me look at my notes.
And this is for this year's Gold Cup.
This year's Gold Cup, we had a Martinique player sent off in their game against El Salvador, where he came and he stepped on the player's foot with excessive force, and the referee showed a straight red. Those of us who watched the video preparations for the referee and that was shared with the players thought it was a little bit harsh, but we could understand because the guy came in with excessive force that it just wasn't a normal stepping on of the opponent's foot.
Yeah, it makes sense. So is it not an automatic red typically? It could be, but it may not.
Excessive force is always the key.
Always a key. Okay.
Okay. As to what's a send off. I mean, I'm not talking about denial of obvious goal scoring chance or deliberate handball to save a goal. When you're talking about serious foul play, the key is excessive force.
Is it me or is the handball calls like the most difficult?
Well, it's not you.
Okay.
And it's not me either. That they've changed the handball rules so many times in the past 10 years. I think they got it right now. But for example, just last year or the year before in the rule book, there was the rule that if the player made a deliberate play with his foot or his head, and then the ball hit the hand, that was not considered a handling, even if the hand was above the head, okay? But there were so many instances where you couldn't tell, you know, whether it was deliberate or not. So they finally changed it and said, now look, if the player has their hand anywhere that makes their body bigger for the play that they're trying to perform, okay? The unnatural position for the play they're trying to perform, that player takes a risk of having their hand in that position. And if the ball hits their hand, not I mean, there used to be the word deliberate. It used to have to be deliberate handling. Well, what's deliberate? You can't say the deliberate, you know, if it makes you can't read the player's mind. So there is no more deliberate. If the hand is in an unnatural position, making the player's body bigger, and the ball hits the hand, he hasn't done it deliberately, but it's considered that player takes a risk from having his hand in that position, and he can be penalized.
I remember that was like the exact words when they had to make that handball call with Jack Grealish in the FA Cup against Manchester United. They said that if the guy makes the play big or something, it was exactly what you said.
Yeah.
Interesting. Cool. Of course, you did refereeing, coaching, playing, but you also started the number one soccer camp in America back in the late 70s. You have big goalkeepers from the U.S. have been through those camps, like Nick Raimondo, Brad Friedel, Miola, Oli, Brianna Scurry, even Hercule Gomez. He's not a goalkeeper, but he went through your camp, right?
Yeah, because we added field players to the camp after about 10 years. Hercules Gomez was a camper in our camp at Long Beach, California. And I didn't even know that until he came up to me when he was working for Fox and he told me about it. So that was cool. Yeah, soccer camps were a big deal in the late 70s, even early 70s. And nobody was doing goalkeepers. So I actually was visiting and working at a lot of other people's camps. And I was doing the goalkeeper instruction and everybody's, oh, wow, well done. So eventually I said, well, I'm gonna start my own camp just for goalkeepers. And people made fun of it at first. They said, what are you gonna teach them? There's nothing to learn. How are you gonna keep them busy for a week? And I guess I proved them wrong. But we started, the first camp was in Connecticut, where I was living at the time. And we had 39 goalkeepers from 13 states. And, you know, because I had made a name for myself, because I was working as the goalkeeper instructor in all the U.S. soccer coaching schools from 1974 through middle 80s, I guess. So a lot of coaches were sending their goalkeepers, high school goalkeepers, some college goalkeepers, even younger ones. And then we did such a good job that first year that we went also in Connecticut. We went from having 39 goalkeepers to over 200 in 1 week. And they came from 39 states. And by the third year, we expanded to Texas, Chicago, and California. And by year five, we had maybe 20, 25 sites all over the country. And you're right. 1 year, we had five starting goalkeepers in MLS. We're all graduates of the camp. See if I can remember. Like you said, Nick Raimondo, Matt Reese, John Bush, Joe Cannon. Oh, boy. And I'm sure there's one other, and he's going to kill me. Okay. For not remembering. But also Dave Vannoli was a five-year camper. He was the national team goalkeeper. Yeah. Tim Harris, who was the Olympic team goalkeeper. Brianna Scurry came for a week as a staff coach. So did Tony Miola. So did Brad Friedel. A lot of the NASL goalkeepers came because I was paying them very well. And they were not making a lot of money in the NASL. So they work a week for me, and then they went out and they started their own goalkeeper camps. But after 10 years or so, we decided that we needed to do more than just do technique. Mostly I was teaching technique, which is how to do things, you know, how to dive, how to catch. And we needed to do more, and we needed tactics. You know, the when, the where, the why. And you couldn't do the tactics with only goalkeepers because back then goalkeepers couldn't play. Back then goalkeepers, you know, the rule was the goalkeeper could use their hands on a pass back from a teammate. The goalkeeper could use their hands even from a throw-in from a teammate. So when they changed that rule and made the goalkeepers have to play with their feet on a pass back or a throw-in from a teammate, okay, then goalkeepers realized that they had to learn to play. You know, and then coaches like Guardiola and others began to put the goalkeeper into the team and make them part of the team where they play out of the back and, you know, and beat players, beat opponents because they can play out of the back, but it's only because the goalkeeper is a player. So I now have a new word. I don't call the goalkeepers anymore. I call them goal players.
That's a good one.
Goal players.
Yeah, and you're right. Guardiola has gotten every player in the field to do everything. You know, the goalkeeper played a little bit more forward. And it's evolving a whole lot. One thing I don't see is goalkeepers scoring on the corner or on a free kick. Like, free kick, but not in a corner situation where they had to tie up the game or they want to win the match. I have not seen that yet.
Well, it has happened. And if you go to YouTube and you put that in, you can find the two or three times that it's happened in the last 5 years. You know, it's, don't forget, when the goalkeeper comes up, you now have 21 players in the penalty area. It's a lot more crowded and a lot more difficult to score the goal with that many people involved. Typically the ball doesn't bounce in the penalty area with that many players.
So in my research, one of your players in your camps, Tony Meola, you have a lot of stories about him. Can you say one of them at least?
Oh, sure. So when we started the campaign to qualify for 1990, our two goalkeepers were Dave Vannoli and Jeff Duback. Okay, our first game in qualification, we went away to Costa Rica and we lost 1-0. And the next game was at home, but also against Costa Rica, as you're playing home and away. And we were playing in St. Louis Soccer Park. And we decided, Coach Bob Gansler and I decided that we'd change the goalkeeper just to change, you know, the situation. Dave Vannoli was big. He was strong. He dominated the area against CONCACAF, at least. He used to play with an American flag up his sleeve, and he would put one in the goal. And the players loved him and loved playing for him. And it just so happens that we won that game 1-0, and he saved a penalty kick in the final minutes. So he became our goalkeeper for the rest of qualifying until now there was a thing called the Marlboro Cup. So in Giant Stadium, back then it was not called MetLife, it was Giant Stadium in New Jersey. And Vannoli shows up to camp in New Jersey and he's injured, he can't play. So we'll have to have a backup goalkeeper for Duback. Right. And so we're in New Jersey, school is out, and Tony Meola lives down the block. Okay. So
Jersey boy.
Yeah. So he's got friends on the team, Ramos and Hawks, and they say to us, to Bobby, call Tony, he lives down the block. So we did. And I gave him a brief workout. And now he's the backup goalkeeper for Marlboro Cup. Turns out the first game is against Sporting Lisbon, I think. And Duback gets hurt. So we have to put in Meola. And he finishes the game and we win the game. And the next game is against Peru national team. And actually it's my only game as head coach because Bob Gansler left to go home because he had two sons graduating, one from high school, one from college. And he asked for permission to go back to Milwaukee for their graduations. So I had the team. And it turns out we won that game 3-0 and Meola shined. And so now he becomes the starter. And Vinoli becomes the backup. And Miola gets four straight shutouts in the rest of qualifying. 2-1-0 games and 2-0-0 games, including the game against Trinidad Tobago, where the so-called shot heard around the world, where Paul Caligiuri scores, where Trinidad Tobago only needed a tie to go to the World Cup. We needed to win in that game. So Miola plays flawlessly. Caligiuri scores a goal, and we get to go to Italia 90 World Cup. And he becomes a superstar. You know, then goes drafted by the Kansas City first Metro Stars, and then Kansas City. Bob Gansler was the coach, and he brings him there. He wins an MLS Cup. He's the MVP of that game. And now he's in broadcasting.
Yeah, yeah, he's on this year's Gold Cup on Fox Sports. Let's rewind back to that 1989, the shot that was the goal that was heard around the world. I have a weekly guest named Hal Phillips. He wrote a book about
Generation
Zero. Yes. And that was one of the most pivotal points for the U.S. soccer team. Can you tell your experience with that? Because that was the first World Cup that we go since I believe 1950. Yeah. Can you tell us your experience with that?
40 years. So there was certainly a lot of pressure. We had a very young team made up of college kids and a few players that had some European experience. There was no outdoor league at the time, so to speak of, no major professional outdoor league. So the team that we put together, was basically inexperienced, as actually were the coaches in dealing with the World Cup. It was decided that we would do 1 week residency for that game. And we assembled at a place called Cocoa Expo in Cocoa Beach, Florida. And it was a former baseball stadium where the Montreal Expos used to have their preseason training, spring training. And we stayed there and we trained there. And on Wednesday of that game, of that week before our game on Sunday, we brought in Bermuda for a practice game because it was felt that in some ways, the way Bermuda played would be the way that Trinidad played. You know, it would be somewhat similar. We either tied or we won by one goal. Maybe we lost by one goal. But after the game, the feeling was not good. You know, it was felt that we should have done better. So spirits were down. And a lot of people were saying we had no chance. Trinidad had some really good players. They were so confident. They had tied us at home 1-1 on a late goal, but they were so confident that they were going to beat us that they declared the next day, Monday, a national holiday. It was celebration. The people were in the stadium 8 o'clock in the morning for a 1 o'clock game. Very few American fans were there. Very few journalists were there. The game was covered by ESPN. JP Della Camera, who's still working today, and Seamus Mallon, who was also the voice color commentator for the Cosmos. He did the color. And FIFA changed the referee assignment just before the game because they knew how important the game was. They wanted to make sure the referee had the right experience. So instead of the referee coming from Venezuela, they changed it to Argentina. And the whole crew came from Argentina. And for this referee, the game was the game was like a high school game almost because of the, you know, the kind of quality games that he was refereeing. It was a piece of cake for him. We did have one close call. John Doyle, one of our center backs, fouled the player. It was one of those, should I call a penalty or not call a penalty? Referee decided against the penalty. Caligiuri scored the goal. Miola got a shutout the rest of the way, and we won the game 1-0. We didn't have any champagne in the locker room. Trinidad Tobago came and brought us their champagne. Because that, you know, they were that kind, but we didn't even think of it. You know, and that's the story. When we came home, we flew into Miami and nobody met us at the airport. It wasn't, you know, it was not a big deal. American soccer had not taken off yet. I mean, we were playing our home games in St. Louis Soccer Park for 5,000 and 6,000 people. So nobody greeted us at the airport. And then shortly thereafter, the game was, I think, November 19th. And then after the holidays, we assembled the team again in California. And we began training for the World Cup. And we added some new players. We added Eric Winalda, for example, and a couple other new players as we learned more about players and tried to strengthen the team a little bit.
Amazing, Dr. Joe. This is a whole different perspective from that time because, you know, it's huge history. And that team that was put together, I know, you know, was probably one of the best teams since in like 40 years because there were a few players playing in Europe, right?
Right, guys. Ramos had European experience. Parks had European experience. Caligiuri had European experience in the second or third division Germany. And, you know, one of the things that also gets covered or doesn't sometimes is that FIFA was threatening. FIFA had never awarded a World Cup to a country that couldn't qualify for the World Cup on their own. So the rumor was circulating, not, you know, amongst the administrators, maybe it was true, maybe it was not, that if we didn't win that game, we don't get the 94 World Cup. So we don't get the 94 World Cup, there's no MLS. Okay, because the financing for MLS came from the proceeds of the 94 World Cup hosted in the USA. Now we have the biggest moments for soccer ever in the USA. Okay, now we have Gold Cup going on now, Women's World Cup starting near the end of the month, be on television all over the place. Next year, next summer, Copa America in the US with six members of CONCACAF, I believe, playing in it.
Yes.
Also, the following summer, 2025, FIFA has given the first big U.S. Club World Championship. I'm not sure, 16 or 24 teams. So the Man U's and the Barcelonas and all of them are going to be here playing in meaningful games, not exhibition tour games, but meaningful games. And then the following summer is 2026 World Cup. Soccer is going to be on every magazine cover, on every late night television show. It's going to be like, boom, right? And the following year is the next Women's World Cup. So, you know, I mean, from not having a pro league in 1990, 89, 90 to where we are now, that team, and there's been several books written about it now, that team did a lot for the future of soccer in America.
Also, Lionel Messi coming to Miami.
Also,
we'll see how that goes, Dr. Joe. And also,
How can it go wrong? Is it $5,000 to buy a ticket?
Exactly, he can't go wrong there. I would like to give you credit because, you know, for a long time, I think our best position for a long time was like the goalkeeper position. You would see like the best American goalkeepers going to the best clubs, Man United, Tim Howard, Miola, and all that. Even
Brad Friedel played for Tottenham. Yeah, but there's a reason for that is because back then goalkeepers didn't have to be soccer players. They had to be shot stoppers. Okay. So, and for the most part, it was eye to hand coordination. Okay. So we were good because all of our other sports require eye to hand coordination. But as the goalkeepers become, the need for goalkeepers to become more field players, the demands get greater. So we have some goalkeepers playing in Europe, but not in the big clubs starting regularly.
Correct.
The big clubs, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Hopefully that will change soon. But yeah, you're right. Goalkeepers are becoming more field players, which is unbelievable. Full total football. I guess they're taking it from the Dutch strategy. But wow, this is an incredible interview. I enjoyed it so much, Dr. Joe. I mean, I love the sport so much. I started watching the sport back in the World Cup USA in 1994. It just blew my eyes. I was like, I cannot watch. I mean, I could not stop watching the sport, and I just saw US soccer just growing and growing. Yeah. And yeah, we had some dips, you know. Back in 18, we lost against Trinidad. That was a big dip. But this squad was
Time out for a second. Everyone says we lost to Trinidad, but two games before we lost to Costa Rica at home.
Yeah,
that was the 3 points, you know, that we needed. Had we won those 3 points, Trinidad game would have been meaningless.
And we played in New York. We played in St. Louis.
I was at the game. And after that game, they said that we'd never play another national team game in New York against, you know, a Central American opponent. And look at the crowd they had there the other night at the beginning for El Salvador, right?
Yeah, it was at Red Bull Arena.
Yeah, yeah. So, and then Costa Rica also played in the same bill. But El Salvador's, they left after their first game. Yeah.
Unbelievable. Times have changed. Venues are important now. Now there's 32. Well, there's about 30 clubs in the MLS, almost 30. Looking forward to it. So Dr. Joe, if you had to pick one of your favorite goalkeepers of all time in America, who would it be? Who would you be your top three?
Well, I'm not going to answer that question because that'd be favoritism, but you know, I did get enchanted back in the day in 90 with Rene Higuita.
Yes.
From Colombia.
You know, my parents are from Colombia. So
okay, well, Higuita. I didn't know. I didn't know. So I mean, he took the attacking goalkeeper, sweeper keeper or whatever. He took it beyond. To the point where he got burned against Cameroon. I think, yeah, Cameroon. In Naples, yeah, I was at the down. Game.
Yeah.
Yeah, he got burned there, and that was the end of him. But he brought something different, you know, where the goalkeeper was not just a shot stopper, mm-hmm. but had to be a soccer player. There were other goalkeepers like that before him. There were one or two, Gilavat from Chile, I think, used to take their penalty kicks and some free kicks. And there was a German too that played for 1860 Munich, a Yugoslavian that played for 1860 Munich. Sometimes it's hard for me with names now, but that was the beginning of that. Hey, look, you want to ask my favorite right now is Matt Turner.
Matt Turner's amazing.
Because what a story.
Came out of nowhere, Dr. Joe.
Right? What a story. And he played at Fairfield University. I told you I lived in Connecticut 30 years. That's, I think he was a walk-on there.
Yeah, he was.
Right?
That's correct.
So he makes his way and he gets somehow drafted or selected to go to New England. Okay, he has a good career, a college career, but now the coach is Brad Friedel in New England, right? And Brad works with him for how many years? I don't know.
I think two at max.
Yeah, Brad does say in the press publicly, that someday Matt Turner is going to be the national team goalkeeper.
It worked out.
He said that publicly, right? So now look, he doesn't, I don't want to be disrespectful. He's not 6 foot eight, 250 pounds, you know? So he's
light.
Controlling the penalty area with skill and knowledge and anticipation as opposed to the physical elements of the game. So, and he seems to have good leadership ability. Goalkeeper's got to be a leader. Goalkeeper, you know, is the only player on the field that sees everything all the time. What I really like, he requested to be held back to play in this Gold Cup. All of the other players with European attachments went home, right? He requested to stay and play, which is just shows you, you know, what he's made of.
And I hope Arsenal will give him a lot more playing time next season.
Yeah, or loan him to somebody where he can play.
Correct. Can you make predictions for the Gold Cup, or you want to stay away from that?
Look, as it turns out, we're now in a different group than Mexico. We won't play Mexico until we get to the final. Right? And assuming both teams get to the final. It's not going to be an easy path. You know, it's the game against Canada is going to be difficult.
Yeah, Canada's tricky.
Yeah.
Not sure what to think of them.
It's going to be difficult. It's going to be 1-0, 2-1 max. The next game
could be between between Panama or Qatar. And Qatar, we faced them 2 years ago.
Right. 1-0.
Yeah, 1-0. Tight match.
1-0. So Panama has presented a good team for this Gold Cup. They're playing, they're strong, right? I don't know how many players from Qatar got second yellow cards in their game against Mexico. How many will be suspended? I haven't done that homework yet.
Ugly match.
But quite a few.
Yeah.
So Qatar might be on the man for that game, which would mean Panama would move forward. So then we've got, if we beat Canada, assume the next game is Panama, and then Mexico. It's, they're all good games.
Jamaica's, you know, a good squad. They have four Premier Leagues.
Happy they're in the other group.
Yeah, so the other bracket. I can see Jamaica going all the way.
We barely tied them.
I know. The only thing, they have, you know, four Premier League players, but they're all in the front. There's not much of a midfield presence.
But they got the goalkeeper, MLS goalkeeper of the year.
True. It's a good talent, right? There. And there's some young Jamaicans that are coming up in the ranks, you know, playing for Chelsea. So we're going to see this. Hopefully, well, Jamaica will hopefully qualify to the USA World Cup. But we'll find out.
Well, I think, you know, with Mexico, Canada, and U.S. automatically qualifying for 2026. It's wide open for how many CONCACAF teams that
Panama, Salvador, Jamaica, maybe Costa Rica. So we'll find out more about it. You have a book called So Now You Are a Goalkeeper. Can you tell us about that, and how can people find it?
Well, nobody can find it. There's a goalkeeper by the name of Franz Hook. He actually was the assistant coach to Holland at this past World Cup. And he's always been Louis van Gaal's assistant. So he's been at Man U. He's been at Barcelona. He's been several places. And he was a player at Volendam in Holland, and which is a lower club in the first division. And when he stopped playing, he was also a school teacher. And he wrote to me and said, I want to come to America and learn about camps, because there was no such thing as camps in Europe for kids, because they were all in the club system, right? So he came and he came to America, he spent maybe 6 summers with us. He was fabulous. Teacher, coach, and demonstrator. And so he had this book that he wrote in Dutch. And I asked him permission to have it translated. And then I Americanized it, but primarily it's So Now You Are a Goalkeeper by Joe Macnick and Franz Hook, but you have to give Franz a lot of the credit And it's quite good. It's, you know, I sold over 20,000 copies, which is good for, you know, for not a widely distributed book. But I sold it to the kids who came to camp. And it's not in print right now. And would have to be totally rewritten if we were to put it in print now, because the position has changed so much.
It has evolved very much. Dr. Joe Mahashnik, what is the best way to reach you online?
Well, online is Joe Mahashnik at number1soccercamps.com is my email address. At Dr. Joe Mahashnik is the Twitter page, so we can communicate that way, direct message if need be. And that's it. I mean, you know, I'm not, do a little bit of social media, but not a lot.
You can find Dr. Joe on Fox Sports for every Gold Cup match, and he'll be back for the Women's World Cup as well, and then of course Copa America in a year from now.
Actually, let me just interrupt before we sign off. I'm not working every Gold Cup match or every World Cup match. I'm sharing the duties with Mark Clattenburg, who's a former FIFA referee, World Cup referee, Europe, big referee in Europe. So he has a similar device that I have in his home in Spain. So like, for example, I have Saturday's quarterfinals. He has Sunday's quarterfinals.
Oh,
so coming up this weekend on Gold Cup.
Well, you have all the USA matches.
Not this weekend. I did have the USA game on Sunday, but he requested a change for personal reasons. He's got something, a family function. And so I volunteered to switch with him.
Oh, sounds good. Dr. Joe Mahashnik, soccer legend in American sports, part of the Hall of Fame as well. And do you have any closing words?
I'm hoping that your listeners, number one, enjoyed it, found it interesting. I found it interesting just going back in my memory lane. The history of the game is sometimes forgotten. People coming into soccer today, you know, think that it's always been like this. It certainly hasn't.
It's moving fast.
You know, there are several books out there now, and maybe some movies are going to be produced, hopefully, that will talk about the history of the game and how we got where we are, and the contributions of some a lot more important people than I was.
Yeah, a lot of history out there, and I hope that people will just dig in and how much people have sacrificed and pioneered over the sport of soccer here in America. Hopefully it will scale much more and all that. And of course you can reach us at thesportscast.net or on Twitter on the sportscast one on Twitter and also Instagram. Have you seen that movie Soccer Town USA?
Yes, I have.
Which kind of touches base of the New Jersey and John Hark's and
New Jersey connection, right? And the Kearney Scots and very good. I have seen it.
Pretty good. Anyway.
All right, my friend.
Well, thank you, Dr. Joe. I appreciate coming on to the Sportscast.
All right. It's been a pleasure.